You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Before we get into the next story, this is a warning. There are graphic descriptions of violence that might be difficult for some listeners to hear. Nicole Beverly was abused for years by her ex-husband, Kevin Beverly. He's now serving time for an aggravated stalking conviction. But he's scheduled to be released from the Newberry Correctional Facility on August 24th. And since her ex-husband went to prison, Nicole Beverly's been hearing that he's threatening to kill her, to kill their two teenage sons. He's allegedly tried to hire other inmates to do the job. With Kevin Beverly's parole date fast approaching, Nicole believes she must act quickly to save herself and her family. Nicole Beverly, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Can we go back to when you and Kevin first met and married? How long ago was that?
Well, we met in college. So we both attended Eastern Michigan. And when we first met, it was a normal dating relationship. Charming, funny, seemed like a great person. And back then, I didn't know the red flags to look for in dating in terms of someone with abusive personality. So the things that I thought were showing that he cared about me were more signs of jealousy and control. But it took
such
me.
As, what kind of signs?
So early in the relationship, it would be he didn't like my friends or wouldn't want me spending time with my friends. He would contact me all the time. Where are you? Who are you with? If I did spend time with my friends, he'd be upset about it. But it was sporadic. There would be times when things were great also.
And you're in love.
Right.
So, yes. And that progressed. So you got married.
We did. We got married. We had our two children. And over time, the emotional abuse got more severe. So he would be controlling but also put me down a lot. So I'd have frequent put downs of being stupid, being ugly, being fat, being lazy. So my self-esteem got broken down. And then over time, the physical violence started to seep into the relationship where it would be if I did something he didn't like, he might push me or grab my arm. So then over time, the pushes got harder. He might push me down on the ground. And then there was a night in particular where he attacked me pretty brutally.
How?
Well, the situation that happened is my sons and I had come back from dinner. And we had a bird that was kept building a nest above our porch. And then the birds would poop on the porch. Mm-hmm. So he decided that he was going to knock the nest down and kill the baby birds. And my youngest son was devastated. He was crying. So I'd made the decision to take him to my mother's house. And my ex-husband wasn't having that. So he knew I was going to leave, and he reacted very strongly. And I could tell by the look at his eye that something very negative was going to happen because previous to this, the violence had been increasing. His threats had been increasing. And I attempted to leave because I knew. And as I was trying to flee from the garage, he grabbed me by my hair and pulled me back into the garage. I did yell for help. Several times, but he's 6'4". At that point in time, he was probably about 360 pounds. And he dragged me into the house and ordered our boys to go upstairs. And he proceeded to punch me, kick me. He jumped with his full weight on my ribs. He dragged me into our living room, kitchen area, which was open, and made me sit at the table. And he went into his office, which was one room over, and got his gun. And he told me if anyone had heard me yelling for help and had called the police, that he was going to shoot the officers that answered the door and then kill me. And then he proceeded to hold the gun to my head for I couldn't even tell you how long, because I just remember him telling me everything that was wrong with me and all the reasons he should kill me while he had held it to my head. And he ranted and raved. And I thought about running, but I knew I wouldn't have enough time that he would shoot me. Mm-hmm. He took my phone. He took my keys, which is what abusers typically do so that you can't leave or contact anyone for help. And he called me off work the following day, and I believe it was over a weekend. So there was a few days before I went back to work because I did have quite a few bruises. And the next morning when he got up, and of course I had to be in the same room with him at all times, he told me that I owed him an apology for almost making him kill me. And I knew that day that everything had changed and I wasn't going to get apologies anymore. He was getting something off of the power and control he had over me. And from that day forward, there were threats of if I told anyone what would happen to me, if I tried to leave him, what would happen to me.
And that's when you stop and go, did you think of calling the police? I'm sure you did, but then he's telling you, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill the police officer if somebody comes.
Right. And he kept my phone for several days, and he kept all the phones from the house. So there was no way I could call anyone. And his threats were very graphic in nature, that if I left, he was going to hunt me down, that he was going to slit my throat, that he was going to shoot me and paralyze me, that he was going to throw acid in my face, that no matter how far I went, he was going to track me down. And I knew that he was serious, and I knew he was capable of doing those things. So it took me 4 months before I told anyone what was happening.
And what year was this?
This was in 2009.
All right. So how did you get out of the marriage?
So I eventually, after about 4 months, told my mom what was happening and contacted Safe House.
Had she guessed?
No, she had no idea.
Really? All that time it had been ramping up.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, like, I think she recognized that he was emotionally abusive, but I think the physical abuse was a surprise to her and everyone that we knew, because on the surface, we had a beautiful home, we had nice cars, we had beautiful children. On the surface, everything looked wonderful. So people were shocked when they found out what was really happening.
So you tell your mom, and this is 4 months after this terrible, terrible episode you described. What did it take to get away from this man who said, no matter where you go, I'll follow you?
So I called Safe House also and got information about creating a safety plan. And what I started to do was to copy documents, important documents, when he was at work, because I knew once I left, I would never get them. I took a few things out of the house at a time, clothing for the children, clothing for myself. And then I had been told that if I wanted any pictures, if there's anything irreplaceable, I needed to get it out before I left because I would never see it again. And that ended up being absolutely true, because most of my belongings were gone when I was finally able to get into the house to retrieve them. So over a few weeks' time, I did that, and I filed for a personal protection order. And the day that the personal protection order was approved, I picked up the kids from school, and we went to my sister's house in Canada for 2 weeks to stay safe and assess the situation.
What finally landed him in prison?
So it was quite a lead up. Once I left, things really didn't improve. There was a domestic violence charge where he came to my home, attempted to enter my home once I had left and was renting a house. And he threw a cigarette in my face. I called 911, and the charge was domestic violence. He ended up being put on probation. And then from that point, it was probation violation after personal protection order violation. There was then an aggravated stalking charge that got pled down to a stalking charge. Then there was the most recent charge in 2012 for aggravated stalking that actually stayed an aggravated stalking charge.
What happened in Oakland County during that aggravated stalking charge in 2012?
So when I had reported to his probation officer that he was threatening me, I actually had text messages and voice recordings of the threats. I was instructed that when he reported for probation that they were going to arrest him and charge him again with violating probation and personal protection order. So I got a phone call, and I was assuming that the phone call was going to be say, yep, it's okay, we've arrested him, because I was living in fear at that time. I was constantly looking over my shoulder. I had to know where exits were at all times, which I still do. And the phone call that I got was not stating that they had arrested him. The phone call that I got was that when the probation officers went to arrest him, they told him why and that he fought them off and fled the building. And they did not know his whereabouts. And I then had to file my own police report before anyone would take action to try and help us. And my children and I had to leave our home for 5 days. And finally, Washtenaw County authorized a SWAT team to look for him. They were unable to locate him. And on the fifth day, they authorized U.S. Marshals. And the U.S. Marshals were able to find him in Dearborn.
And Kevin Beverly was finally in prison, but that did not end the nightmare for Nicole Beverly.
two inmates came forward at Jackson Prison writing letters stating that my ex-husband was on a regular basis saying that as soon as he got out, he was going to come to my home and kill my children in front of me.
I'm speaking with Nicole Beverly, who was abused for many, many years by her ex-husband, Kevin Beverly, who is now, she's heard since he's been in prison, now he's at the Newberry Correctional Facility, that he is continuing to threaten to kill her and kill their two sons, and he is due to be paroled this coming August 24th. How did you find out? You've been told by authorities that he's made threats against you. I mean, how did you learn this?
Yes, and there have been multiple attempts to hire that I've been notified. The first one was in Washtenaw County.
To hire inmates.
To hire inmates. Okay. The first one was in Washtenaw County in 2012, and that was when he was awaiting sentencing on the aggravated stalking charge. An inmate came forward there stating that my now ex-husband had approached him and offered him $50,000 to chloroform me and inject me with a lethal dose of heroin. And that inmate passed a polygraph test. He was willing to testify and or wear a wire if Washtenaw County would cut him some type of a deal. And at that time, Washtenaw County prosecutors decided not to do that. So the inmate was unwilling to testify or wear the wire. And I had been notified about that investigation by Washtenaw County Sheriff's Department. Then fast forward to him being transferred to Jackson Prison, he was approved for parole after 15 months, which was his minimum sentence date. And the day that they transferred him from Jackson Prison to the Detroit Reentry Center, which is a step down before you're paroled, two inmates came forward at Jackson Prison writing letters that are quite compelling, stating that my ex-husband was on a regular basis saying that as soon as he got out, he was going to come to my home and kill my children in front of me.
I can't imagine what the normal is for you and your sons having this onslaught of threats. I don't know how to imagine it.
Yeah, it's almost something we've become used to. And after the letters, and I do have copies of the letters, like I said, that were very graphic and are very difficult to read. They did contact Detroit Reentry Center, and they pulled him into isolation, and two inmates came forward there saying that he was offering them $50,000 to kill me and my children. And he was saying that the money, because people always ask me, well, how would he have that much money? And what he was stating at that time was that he still had a life insurance policy on me. And there was a life insurance policy, and it had a very high cash out. But the other thing is he had taken all of our assets. So we don't know how much money he had. He had taken about $80,000 out of all of our retirement savings, education funds for the kids. So I don't know. The money potentially was there.
So he was supposed to be paroled. He was a step away from being paroled. They pulled him back. And then did he get resentenced to what happened to keep him in?
So once I was notified about the inmates at Jackson writing the letters and the inmates at Detroit Reentry coming forward saying he was soliciting them for my murder, state police in Wayne County were handling that investigation. They had interviewed those inmates and were going to be going back to interview them and potentially wire them for further evidence. And the day that detective went back to complete that investigation, he learned that without his knowledge, in the police report, it states he doesn't understand why, Jackson Prison had pulled my ex-husband back to Jackson before the investigation could be completed and before any wired evidence could be obtained. The case then was assigned to a detective, another state detective, and 3 weeks went by, and Washtenaw County, again, was trying to help and find out what was happening in the case, made some phone calls. The detective then learned he was supposed to be not only finishing up the investigation about the case at Detroit Reentry, but also the letters written at Jackson Prison, and he made the decision to simply interview my ex-husband and decided based on his body language that he was telling the truth and that he was not wanting to hurt me or hire anyone to hurt me simply based on his body language.
So he dismissed all that as unfounded.
He dismissed it all as unfounded, and there was no follow-up by the state police.
And I know ultimately your ex wound up in Newberry, and the same thing happened. Somebody agreed to wear a wire, right?
That is correct. He, as a result of the letters, the Michigan Department of Corrections did make the decision to not authorize his parole. And he eventually was sent to Newberry Correctional Facility in the Upper Peninsula. And I received a phone call in November stating that another inmate had come forward stating that my ex-husband was offering him now $5,000 to kill me and to kill me in the same way that the first inmate in 2012 was going to kill me, and that was with a lethal dose of heroin.
I think of the story you're telling, and it seems that there are so many movable parts in all of this, so many different agencies. And I'm wondering, as you turn to all of these agencies, to the police, to the parole, to the prison authorities, what happens?
Well, it's been very surprising to me how little flow of communication there is between all of these entities, because when I was contacted by each of these state police detectives, none of them were aware of the previous cases.
His time's about up. He gets out August 24th, unless?
My understanding, the inmate at Newberry was willing to wear a wire. He was not asking for a deal. He wasn't asking for anything, any time off. He just was reportedly very concerned about the boys and I being murdered. And he wore a wire on several occasions. And my understanding, although I have not yet seen the police report from talking to the detective, is that the wire that had the most evidence was inaudible due to a football game being on in the background, and that they were unable to separate enough of the clear audio to, in the opinion of the prosecutor in Luce County, he made the decision not to move forward with charges because he feels an inmate's testimony isn't enough. I have not talked to him personally. That's just what I've been told. And my question has been, well, I understand one inmate, but what about six inmates? Is that not credible enough to have all of these people coming forward and trying to help us and having been willing to do that?
Do you see any avenue that could keep him locked up past August 24th?
My understanding is that the Attorney General's office has the most power to do something to help us at this point in time, being that there are cases from multiple counties that could potentially be pulled together into one case, that the Attorney General's office is our best hope at getting new charges and getting the help that we need to stay safe and to be able to stay in Michigan.
Because we know that August 24th is the parole date. He's supposed to be released with a tether monitor with GPS, but isn't that just for the first 60 days, or would he wear that?
His max sentencing date is October 24th of this year. So once he hits that date, he is off of everything. And that was something that I wasn't aware of. My having never really dealt with the legal system before, I assumed that once you hit that max sentencing date, then you were put on parole, but that's not the case. The case is, once he hits that max sentencing date, there's nothing. There's no one to hold him accountable. There's no one watching his movement. There's nothing.
Tell us about the safety plan that you had to put together and follow.
So as the release date was approaching for my ex-husband, Washington County prosecutors and sheriff's department wanted to come together with my family to create a safety plan that would involve having my house highlighted so that if I called 911, it would be a fast response. Also, having SWAT come to my house to map it so that if there is a hostage situation or he ends up in my home, they would already have a layout of my home. They also requested dental records for myself and my children because they realize the lethality risk that my ex-husband poses to us. So we kind of sat down and talked about all these things and put an action plan into place before release.
That's tough to think, okay, here are my dental records and realize why you have to give them.
That was probably the most difficult thing that someone has said to me in terms of that, because it just the reality struck me very hard. And that the fact that they realize and recognize that this is very likely to happen to us. and no one's doing anything.
So what are you going to do?
I'm going to relocate. If the powers that be don't do what we need to do, or for them to do for us to help us, I have to leave the state and I essentially have to disappear.
New identity, new everything.
New everything.
But do you worry about your friends and family who will know where you're at and he'll know them?
I do. I worry about my mom the most, being vulnerable, of course, because, you know, you hear these cases all the time where people get out, and if they can't get to the person they're trying to hurt, they hurt the people closest to them. So that is a very real fear that I have.
There are people listening to your story who are going to want to ask this question, so I will ask it for them. What can people do to help you?
So at this point, I have a friend who has done a few things. The first thing she did initially was set up a GoFundMe for relocation, because once I change my identity, what I'm being told by national experts is that it's going to be very hard for me to obtain employment, because once I have to explain why I've changed my identity and my profession as a clinical social worker, a lot of companies are not going to want to take the risk. I'm putting clients in jeopardy if I'm a safety risk. Then as a result of the GoFundMe, people have also been asking who they can contact. And we've basically are suggesting the Attorney General's office, Bill Schuette, also state representatives, to try to help put a little pressure on the people who have the power to do something to help myself and my children. Yesterday, it was very painful. My younger son made a video. It was a video. He was saying goodbye to his friends and telling them that he had to leave the state and he would never see them again. And it hit me very hard, because as an adult, it's one thing to deal with these things, but for a child, it's so unfair. And one thing I want to say, too, is one of the reasons people ask, well, why don't you just stay and why don't you just have a gun and, protect yourself? And I do have a CPL and I do carry, but I can't carry at work and I can't be looking over our shoulder and I can't be with my kids 24/7 to protect them. And after the safety planning meeting, I was on the fence about whether to leave or not. But there was an incident that occurred about 2 weeks ago where I had to call 911, and it took them an hour and 6 minutes to respond to my call and get to my house. And I knew at that moment that I can't stay here. It's not safe for us.
Nicole Beverly, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.